I am really excited because I have got some great news for you. For the first time ever, I'm offering an Artist Low Comedy Intensive in the fall. It will be the weekend of Saturday, October 24th, and Sunday, October 25th. What you'll learn in this workshop is, before you can be funny, you need to be real. And guess what happens? You're even funnier. You'll learn to slow down your scene work, so you'll be able to tap into your emotional life and your life experiences. And you'll also be able to find the game in the scene quicker. Now, I limit this workshop to only 10 people because it's on Zoom. And if you sign up now, before October 10th, this workshop is only $139. For more information, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. And if you still need a little more Jimmy and the Artist Low Comedy, I will be offering the Artist Low Comedy online level 2 starting November 4th. I limit it to 10 people, and we focus on two-person scenes. For more information or to register, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, the host of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Adam Cawley. He is a 3-time Canadian Comedy Award winning actor. He is also a writer, improviser, and teacher. He is an alumni of the Second City main stage in Toronto, where he wrote 4 reviews. He is the co-host of The Back Line with Rob and Adam, which is described as a weekly improv tutorial. We talk to Adam about variety in improv, how he approaches each improv show in each different venue, and how he deals with jealousy. Before we get to Adam's interview, Lauren and I, on September 9th, I hope I'm getting the date right, we celebrated 8 years of being married. So usually like a week before the day of our anniversary, Lauren will say, hey, do you want to exchange gifts this year? And every year I always say yes, because I love getting gifts. But this year, because of COVID, I'm like, no, I don't need a gift. And she said, well, this year I would like matches, because we can never find matches in this house when we need them. And I'm usually, you know, trying to light, you know, candles off the burners in the stove. So, and then she said later she wanted flowers, but she didn't say anything about a cart, right? So I called up a local flower store in our neighborhood, which I had never used before COVID. And they said, you know, you can't come into the store, but we can put together a nice bouquet. How much would you like to spend? I said about $60. I think it's 65. I went to 65 because, you know, it's 8 years of our anniversary. And they said, fine. They said, you know, just come to the door and knock on the door, and then we'll bring out the flowers. You don't have to come into the store. So I snuck out on my bike and I went and got it, and I was really excited about it. I didn't get the mattress. And that night, that anniversary, I gave them to her, and she loved them. And a couple days later, she said to me that she was hurt and disappointed that she didn't get a mushy card. Because I can write a really, really good mushy card because I love my wife and I love my daughter. So it's not really hard to come up with a mushy card, but I didn't do it. But I'm thinking, look, I spent $77. You know, I don't know if it was tax or they charged me a little extra. And of course I felt ripped off, but I'm like, I just spent $77 on these flowers. And now you're like saying, oh, I feel hurt because I didn't get a mushy card. So about a week later, I'm in Target and I buy a card. I buy a beautiful card of papyrus, $5 or $6, and I get these matches. They're these box matches. So I buy 4 boxes of these matches. It's 300 in each box. We have 1,200. We're going to have enough matches until Betsy goes to college. And I wrap the matches up and I give her the card a week later, because it takes me a while to write the mushy card. I just can't write. I mean, certainly I love my wife and I love my daughter, like I told you, but I'm a perfectionist. So I finally get the card together, I wrap up the matches, and I give it to her. And she's standing in the kitchen reading the card after dinner. She's laughing in the places where I think, you know, there was a good laugh. And then at the end, I tell myself she was kind of getting a teary-eyed. Not the teary-eyed that I wanted. I'm not going to lie to you, I wanted more, but it's still served, you know, the purpose. And then she said, thank you. You know, I really appreciate you giving me this card because I didn't think I was going to get it, which is a surprise in itself, right? You know, you wait 2 weeks after the anniversary. It's a surprise. And I just thought about, like, how crazy I am, because here's how I think, you know, like, I was like, I gave you, you know, I just spent $77 on you, you know, but this is how I think. I equate how much you love me on how much you spend on my gift. Lauren's not that way. And thank God for that. I'm really grateful that she's in my life. And with that, enough about me. And here it is, the Adam Cauley episode. Enjoy. Adam Cauley, thank you for being my guest on Improv Nerd.
My pleasure. I am a big fan.
Thank you. Thank you. And just for our listeners, just so you know, we recorded about 35 minutes of this interview. And then I realized, because we're on Zoom, that I didn't record it. And talk about, this is a great place to talk about shame. I am feeling a tremendous amount of shame.
Don't worry about it. I've had to do this before on my podcast. We'll sometimes realize, we weren't recording. And then you try and do kind of the same podcast. And it reminds me of at Second City, we'd have to do two shows on the same night. And so there'd be moments where in the second show, I'd be looking at my scene partner thinking, did I already say this line? Because I know I've said it today, but did I say it yet in this scene?
So you started out doing improv in high school, doing short form.
Yeah, so I started in the Canadian Improv Games, which is the largest high school tournament in the country. And it was started by David Shepard, who was one of the Compass players. And he started Improv Olympics, which was the precursor to IO. And he kind of created these games, theater games, that were life, story, character, theme, style, and open. And you'd be judged on every scene. You'd get a suggestion with your team. And you know, if you won your region, then you would go on to the next level and the next level. And the final five teams would get to perform at the National Arts Center in Ottawa. And it was an incredible time. Like, I wasn't on any high school sports teams, even though I loved sports. But this really had that camaraderie. Everyone in the school knew us. I got to meet so many improvisers that I still work with today. And, you know, some of the alums that I, from the CIG are like Seth Rogen, Sandra Oh, Tatiana Maslany, Nathan Fielder. So it was a huge part for a lot of, you know, Canadian comedians.
Now, you've admitted this, and we have this in common. We were both fat when we were kids. And how did this, and you were someone who was very funny in school. How did this help with your self-esteem?
I don't think that being fat helped, but I
the improv part. No, being fat did not help with my, if anything, it brought it way down.
Yeah, you know, because I was an athlete, but I was never good enough to make any waves in the athletic world. And so once I found theater and comedy and doing impressions, I would memorize speeches from Ace Ventura and perform them. People, like, it was kind of like, oh, I found what I'm good at. I remember doing my first impression ever, which was Robin Williams as the genie doing Rodney Dangerfield. And for some reason, I'm trying to remember the lines, but the genie is playing chess with the rug, the magic carpet. And then, the rug checkmates the genie and he turns to the camera, makes a Rodney Dangerfield face with a tie. And he goes, I can't believe it. I'm losing to a rug. And I was like, I don't even know who Rodney Dangerfield is, but my parents thought it was great. So I was like, okay, I think I'm going to try and make people laugh now.
Just get divorced. Your dad's not around. So how much of getting, you know, for me, my dad was a workaholic. He wasn't around in a different form, you know, and eventually he goes to jail for white collar crime, which is a whole nother story. But
whoa.
I was always looking for that approval, you know, of a father figure.
I mean, my dad was still around. Like he coached my soccer team. So like I saw him a bunch. I think it was, it definitely was my dad not being in the house and my mom being at work so much, that it was like, where's my audience? I don't have an audience at home. My older brother does not like me. Where do I find this audience? And so the classroom was the natural place. And I kind of remember discovering timing to my, I think it was a fourth grade teacher. She was like, Adam, I need you to keep your comments for after class. And I said, look, it's not going to be funny unless I say it right after you. You make some statement about homework. I make the joke. That's how timing works. And she was not thrilled with that answer. But I think that's where I really started to fall in love with improv, even maybe without knowing what improv was. But it was just like, I don't have anything prepared. Something happens and I react. And I think getting confident in the idea that I'm trusting my own instincts, that what I'm about to say will be funny to other people.
And then at 20 years old, you enroll at the Second City in the conservatory.
Yeah, I was at the Humber College comedy program where you kind of learn sketch, stand-up, script writing, improv. And
at this point, did you know what you, when you went to Humber, did you know what you wanted to be?
No, I remember my final year, like my graduation at high school, I did a stand-up show. And I was like, oh, I think I'll be a stand-up. I was on the improv team, but I did stand-up. Then I went to Humber, and at the Humber program, you were forced to do stand-up sets. There was no improv shows, which kind of sucked, but I was doing stand-up, and I thought was doing okay, but it didn't excite me as much. Especially being alone and repeating the same material again and again. Just, I didn't get the same joy. I felt like I was kind of lying of like, I'm making this all up, everybody. But I definitely wasn't. During Humber, you know, Whose Line Is It Anyway is on. I'm meeting other comedians who loved Second City. And I had been to one Second City show years prior. And I thought it was fine. You know, In Toronto, yeah. And the Toronto Second City is great. Like, it's been around since 73. It's been a huge part of, you know, SCTV and lots of great alums that are from Toronto. But I never even thought about it. It seemed like old person theater. And then once I was at Humber and I met all these people and I had done the high school improv, I was like, I went to Second City and I begged them to let me skip A to E, which is their, you know, first levels. And just let me audition for the conservatory.
And then when I look at your career, this time in a lot of ways becomes the most fertile time, because not only you're studying at Second City, but you start to branch out and you go to festivals and you go to New York to study with UCB and you take Susan Messing's class when she's teaching at festivals and you go to Chicago. How important is that for your development?
Huge. There was one specific trip to Chicago with a troupe I had. We went to the Chicago Improv Festival, had a terrible show. But while we were there, it was my first time in Chicago. I was a student at Second City Toronto. I was like, well, let's go see Second City Chicago. Because I was a student, I got to see the main stage for free. And seeing that main stage show kind of changed everything for me. It was a show called Red Scare, directed by Mick Napier, and I had no idea that sketch comedy, specifically, I guess, review-style Second City shows, could be that aggressive and bold, nuanced and complicated. I hear a lot of people refer to Pinata Full of Bees as what did that for them, and I think this was I've seen Pinata years later, but this show opened up my eyes of the possibilities.
Do you remember something sticking out to you in that show? A scene?
There was, there's lots of funny things, but the opening scene was three separate couples all having a different political point of view. And halfway through, I think the women changed whose partner they were with. And you started to see what would happen if one political ideal was a partner of a different political ideal. What would that conversation be like? And then so much of it was in unison, and the preciseness, it felt like sometimes they would snap into being cyborgs and walk around the stage and then snap into a callback from three scenes ago with a character from a different scene that's calling back the opener, and the whole thing connected at the end. And I think I remember at the end, the crowd was shocked into silence right before the final song, because it's all of these people. It was in 2004, and I think the Patriot Act had just come in. And the cast was screaming their frustrations at the audience, and then silence. And I got goosebumps, and I was like, oh my God, this is a Second City show? I had no idea. And so that changed everything in terms of Second City for me.
And then the second part of it was then branching. So you see this show, and then from there you start going to different festivals and UCB in New York and stuff like that. Why is that important now when you're starting out?
Yeah. I mean, we went on that same Chicago trip, we went to IO, my first time at IO. And in Toronto was at that time, a very short form city. And the little bit of long form I had done was pretty rudimentary stuff. You know, it was sweep edit here and there, tag out.
No one's teaching it in Toronto. You're probably learning it from books and.
Yeah, a lot from books. There was someone who had studied at IO West who had come and taught at Second City. And so that gave us like a good understanding. But the idea of like organic group games, you know, real like follow the follower openers, seeing that and seeing a Harold done well, like this guy was teaching us, but we had no examples of a group of people who had been doing it for years. And so we watched this organic Harold happen. And then my friends and I called over that team and we're like, that was amazing. Would you mind explaining to us what you just did? And they did. Like, if you ask an improviser to like talk to you about improv, they will. They were very lovely. I don't remember the name of the team, but then we kind of went back to Toronto and we said, let's try it. And we did a bunch of shitty shows, trying to copy this form. But then we were like, well, we had such a great time in Chicago. Let's go to the Del Close Marathon. Let's do a show there. Let's go to the Detroit Improv Festival. And so I started to branch out and learn, do as you said, like Susan Messing, and taking with like Joe Bill, Mark Sutton, Mick Napier, opened up my eyes to a different form. Then my UCB was actually in LA, but doing UCB in LA again. Oh, this is a Harold, but your scene structure and your initiations are completely different than anything I've ever learned. And so it just opened up my eyes to the possibilities of improvising. I think that has helped me be less rigid in the way I perform. It's given me a clearer idea of how I approach shows, where I used to want to approach shows with, I'm going to bring my style, or I'm going to try and force the way I think improv should be done on this show. And now I am much more open because I feel like I've had a lot of experience in a variety of styles that I can say, Jimmy, thanks for having me on the show. What's the goal of the show tonight? What do you want to do? And I'm more than happy to serve that show and your goals rather than try and force some preferences of mine onto a show.
So when you learn multiple styles, UCB style, Annoyance style, Second City style, how do you make it work for yourself without having it just drive you insane? Like, I'm not doing it right, you know? Because I see that with a lot of students who, and it's very common in Chicago, where they're studying in multiple places at the same time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've heard you on the podcast say things like, hey, Jimmy, like a student will be like, well, Mick says this is the way to do it. I was probably that way as a student, and I probably annoyed a lot of teachers that way. But now, I was a student at UCB not long ago, And after I was on main stage, and I didn't know what their style was. So I, my first class, my first scene, I initiated very annoyancy. I snapped into a physicality. I held onto my declaration.
You were making a declaration.
Yeah. Just like even a non sequitur opening of just like, how do I do?
Right. Just commit. Keep heightening.
Yeah. And they were like, what the hell are you thinking? And I was like, what's the problem? Like, you haven't even looked at your scene partner or heard their initiation yet. And I was like, yeah, we'll figure it out. Let them initiate how they want to initiate. And they're like, that's not how we do it here. And I was like, okay, you know what? That's the last time I did an annoyance initiation at UCB. I was like, tell me what you want, and I want to see if I can do it. And then doing it, like, oh, I see the benefits of this. Great. Can I master this now? Can I do the best version of what you want me to do? And so that's the goal. It's never about, I've studied at this place. I've done this. Well, then why are you here? Like, again, same with the classroom is the same as a show. If you're so competent in your ways of doing it, why are you here? And so I'm quite open and excited to learn new styles or to do shows where I'm like, I have no idea what the goal of this show is. But I'll see if I can make it a great show. Can I get laughs in your style? Let's see.
But when I hear this, I didn't realize that you had been done with Second City. You had done 4 main stage reviews in Toronto. You won the Canadian Comedy Award for acting 3 times. You had TV and film credits. How was that in your ego? Just let me know what your ego, what was it like to walk into a classroom at UCB after having, you know, all this success and feeling like, you know, and, you know, you had to start at the level 1 there.
Yeah. I had done IO, so they do let you skip level 1. So I did go to level 2. I don't know. I think because I had moved to Los Angeles, I was like, there's a Second City there and I teach there and I teach over at Westside Comedy in Santa Monica. But I was like, I really want to be on a team. And the only way I've been told to get on a Herald team at UCB is to go through the classes. So it's like, okay, I'll go through the classes. I there is some part of my ego that enjoys, it's like I've got a new Infinity Stone on my gauntlet. I've got the UCB training. I can talk intelligently about it. If I'm at, again, as I was saying before, like if I walked up to a UCB Herald team, I could play with them. If I walked up to an Annoyance show, like I used to do Skinprov at the Annoyance, and I'd be like, so Mick, what are we doing tonight? Like, what's the goal? I would never try UCB shit at the Annoyance and vice versa. So in terms of my ego, I kind of enjoyed taking the classes, and I did. I thought they were very good. I definitely, I made a conscious effort to not talk about where I'm from or why I was taking the classes. I just wanted to be a good, being a teacher, I knew what a shitty student was, and I definitely didn't want to be a shitty student.
Ego, because you've talked about this on the podcast, and I think what's just challenging, and it's been for me, and I see it with my students too, is like, how do you find your voice? You know, you hear improv, oh, it's a great place to find your voice, and be supportive of the group that you're on at the same time.
When you say finding your voice, like your comedic voice?
Your comedic voice. You're finding your comedic voice, but, you know, a lot of times you're like, you know, you might not make choices. You might not have the same sensibility as some members on your team. So how do you make that balance where you're not getting in your own way?
Yeah, I think this comes down to variety, and variety is a big thing for me. And I'm not sure if this is your experience in Chicago, but in Toronto, there are, you know, about 5 different improv-based theaters or companies, and there are some players who only play with that company. And there are students who only study at one place, and they only do shows at the one place. And I feel like that is going to inhibit the ability to find your comedic voice because of fear. Because if I go to that other theater, I know they do things differently. What if I suck there? I'm intimidated by them, or I don't like their style. And secretly you're like, I just can't do their style. And so when you stay in that safe zone, you may not be able to explore as much. You don't have different audiences. You don't have different players. You have a singular voice of this one theater, and it can be very difficult to experience all that improv has to offer. So I love the idea of finding your comedic voice by being at every theater, being in front of as many audiences as possible, being on stage with as many different experience levels, points of view, you know, every variety you can think of. And all of those little things will continually add on to the armor that is your comedic point of view. But when you just have that one place, you might be a star at that place, but that's all you're going to ever be able to do. And depending on what your goals are with improv, I never think that that's going to work out well.
There's almost an acceptance or a comforting thing that if you're going to try a different style of improv, for instance, your UCB example, you're going to suck. You're going to suck. How long did it take you to not suck at doing the UCB stuff and starting to start figuring it out for your, you know, doing those scene work?
I don't know if I...
You didn't suck at it?
No. Oh, no, no, I did. Because there was just things where I had to catch myself from, again, my own ego getting in the way of like, you want me to do it that way? And in my head, I was like, I don't think that's the right way to do things.
That's exactly how I'd be.
But then getting over that, like not saying anything, but definitely asking questions in a way that did, I had to make sure, just because I didn't want to upset the teacher, because again, we've talked about having shitty students. I was genuinely curious about the reasons behind some of their choices. And then hearing them, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And then doing them a bunch, I'm like, oh, this is great. I totally get this. This is a lot of fun. So I don't know if I still don't suck at it. I still think there's probably lots I need to learn to excel. I wouldn't say I excel at the UCB style, but I think I have a good handle on it. So I think every level I went through, there was a new challenge of A, accomplishing what they wanted me to accomplish, and B, removing what I thought I should bring to a scene. So it was a challenge, but it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I mean, how much of this in improv, like we're taught to fail because that's how you learn. How did you come to the conclusion of like, you know what, if I'm going to get better at this, or if my goals keep changing, I'm going to need to fail.
Mm. Yeah. Failure sucks. It sucks so
still does.
Bad.
It still does.
Oh my God. I hate it. Of course.
So when you fail, what happens? Like for me, it's like, I honestly, it's suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation.
No,
I'm
going
to kill myself. That's why I'm in therapy. What happens to you when you have a bad show, or you blow an audition, or?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, well, I mean, show and audition, I guess improv, no, they're separate. But for a show, there's a few things, right? There's embarrassment for sure. Shame for sure. Especially if you've invited people to the show, you feel like you've wasted their time.
Throw some students in there too. So people and friends, and then some students.
Students, brutal, and they look at you. You can tell after the show, they're like, hey, that was great. And you're like, oh, you're so regretting my class.
Right, and I have to go teach you in 2 days, you know?
Yep.
Hopefully I'll be over it, hopefully.
Yeah, so definitely. I get very hot. My body, if I'm bombing on stage, I can feel my body radiating heat. So anyway, that's all the terrible feelings. Some ways I've felt about learning how to alleviate those feelings. One is therapy. Therapy's great. Fantastic stuff.
How has therapy helped you with that? Because I've been in therapy for 14 years.
Yeah, I think therapy has it felt like I was carrying a lot of baggage and just slowly removing the baggage of the need to fix things, the need to get ahead of things, to try and control things. Those were all anxieties I would have before a show of, oh God, if I'm playing with this person, how am I going to fix this scene? I got to keep an eye on that because I know that they're not great at connections or whatever it might be. But the idea of like, hey man, relax. So, okay, let me talk about a few things. One being a helpful hint is to always have another show booked. So if I've got a Monday show, I've always got a Friday show. So you fail, you feel shitty, you can, you know, think on why was it shitty? If it's usually yourself, you're like, oh, I was lazy or I didn't commit to anything. I tried to go for the joke in this non-joke heavy show. And then you think, cool, on my Friday show, I'm gonna fix those problems. I'm gonna make adjustments to make the show better. The other thing is, as Susan Messing said to me once, if you don't have fun on stage, you're the asshole. I might be paraphrasing, but something like that. And I found that when I was doing shows, especially other people's shows or being a guest, I would feel frustrated with maybe the style of show they're producing or the way they run it or how they like to improvise. And so I changed my thoughts. My thoughts are now, what is the goal of this show? How can I best serve this particular show or this particular scene and bring out any of the tools that I have from all the years of training and experience to best serve this particular show? Instead of trying to manhandle my views on improv into a bunch of the shows that I was doing. And so when you approach a show with my only goal is to make this the best show ever, then I think you are going to do two things. You're going to have more fun and you're going to work better with the people that are also in the show because you're not working against them trying to bring your annoyance style to the UCB. It's not going to work. And everyone's going to get mad at you. You're going to get mad at them. What a terrible time. So the idea of approaching a show with how can I best serve this show or this scene, I think alleviates a lot of those anxieties or fears you might have at a show.
And how has that helped in terms of the results? You say the fun factor, it's increased. Are you getting a better performance out of yourself? Are you getting more laughs?
I think so. And I learned quite a long time ago that, oh, look, if I'm feeling like I need to experience this style of improv more, then I should probably produce my own show where that is the focus. And so that's what I ended up doing. We've got, there's a place in Toronto called Comedy Bar, which is, it's a theater, it's a comedy theater with no set goal, right? I say it's like a free market of humor. There's stand-up, there's sketch, there's improv, whatever. So we have a show there we had a show for like 16 years at 11 o'clock Friday nights. The only goal of that show was funny. I could ruin your scene, Jimmy, and like tell the audience a horrible secret about your past if it was going to be funny. If it's not, someone will edit me right away. That's the only goal of the show. But then I would do a Monday night show at a place called the Bad Dog Theater, and that was two-person improv. Myself and Rob from the Backline podcast, we do a half-hour grounded one-act play. Those were the two things that I was like, that's what I really need. And then there's another group called The Assembly in Toronto, which is a fantastic long-form theater, and that's where I'm on a Herald team, and I get to experience all those lovely second beats and callbacks and connections. So now, if I'm asked to guest on a show, I get to experience whatever the hell they want me to do. You want me to... It's a Harry Potter-themed show? Fine. Sure, whatever you want. But before I discovered that I need to set up my own shows where I get everything I love out of improv, I think I used to force it on other shows, on these guesting shows. So now I've got my shows that I need and I get to experience all my improv fun. And so now the other shows are just kind of bonus. It's like I'm taking a class. Like, how do you like to do it? Let's try that.
Why do you think that improvisers have such a hard time? Not all of them, but there's a fair amount of like, the idea of creating their own thing is almost daunting.
Is it? I don't know. I think probably city by city things are different. Like with the podcast, we tour around the world, and a lot of places, especially the smaller cities, have one improv theater. And so why would you create your own thing? You don't need to. You're here. I think Toronto was unique in that way, where we would have these stages that were – they needed content. And so unless you were on the main stage or the touring company at the second city or on like a Friday or Saturday night show, we had all these days that needed content. And, you know, once you're done classes, how do you get better? You just do shows. So, yeah, I don't know why it's daunting, because it feels like in Toronto, there's new shows all the time and then new shows closing all the time because they aren't good.
I guess, and maybe I can rephrase the question. I see a lot of times people will get, you know, get caught in the institutions. And if they don't get on a Herald team, their career is over. The thought of them like going out and creating their own thing doesn't even seem like an option.
Totally. Yeah. That, and I think that goes back to what I was saying earlier of like, don't get caught in an institution. Don't put all your eggs in that basket, because they don't owe you anything. They could close, they could, just not want you, your style, whatever it is. But once you start classes at a theater, that's when I'm like, that's the time to start your own show at a small cabaret, a little black box, start building your own thing where you can do what you want. Because even if you get on that main stage or on that Herald team, you're still going to have a coach or a director telling you what they want you to do. So your exploration is still limited. So I would always recommend having your own thing, even if it's the worst show in the city for 5 years. Do it, get better, find your comedic voice, find what you love, because that's only going to help you show those theaters, hey, maybe that person doesn't need me as much as I thought they did. And it's going to make you more valuable and unique whenever you do get hired by those theaters. So the idea of getting caught is heartbreaking to me in a one theater strain.
The other thing, and I don't think you talked about this in your podcast, but it's something I love talking about, and that is jealousy.
Oof.
And you said, ooh, is that something you struggle with as well?
Yeah, I don't know how you can't. I mean, probably you're a better adjusted person than we are.
Thank you, but I don't think so.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. You know, the thing that I've learned over time and being surrounded by extremely talented people is that your career, your improvising career, is very much like a bowling alley, where someone beside you, you're playing bowling, you're both bowling, but the person beside you gets a strike. It literally has zero effect on your game. You see it, but it doesn't affect how many pins you can knock down. You could get a strike your next shot. It has no effect at all. And nobody has gotten a job that's lasted the rest of their life in the arts. So for me, when I see a friend or someone and I feel that tinge of jealousy...
Is it just a tinge? Because me, it just covers my whole body.
Well,
I'm paralyzed for a couple hours.
Really? And then,
yeah. No, it gets better. Therapy has helped it, but it still stings. It doesn't sting as much, but it still stings.
And I think that's okay. I think it's just like the thoughts you can't help, but what are your actions? And so I think the actions for me over time have been, I'm going to support the shit out of this person. Tell them, I am so jealous, but I'm so proud of you. You're amazing. You're going to do so great, because I know it's going to happen to me at some point. Something will, where people will be jealous, and you want them to be supportive of you. That's what friends are, right? Like you have to be supportive in spite of the jealousy. So I think the jealousy is fine, but how do you handle it?
Have you gone to friends and said to them, you know, you got this movie, you got this TV show or whatever, I'm really happy for you, but I'm also jealous.
Yeah.
And what's the response been?
My Rob, the on the podcast, there was a sketch TV show in Canada called Sunnyside, and I had a callback for it, and then I didn't get it. Rob had a callback, but he got it. And he got to film two seasons of this sketch show. And I remember sitting with him in my house and I said, I am so jealous, but I think it's amazing. And he was, I think, I don't know how he felt. I'm sure he felt like, that's nice. It probably feels good for your ego to have people jealous of you. And I think it's nice to get that out in the open, especially between close friends, to say, I wish I had what you had, but I'm so glad one of us got it. Like, you're representing us and our friend group and our team, and you're going to be great. And holding any of that stuff inside is going to eat you alive.
You talked about in the first part of the interview, and we're going to about to...
That was the best part, Jimmy. That interview was so good.
No, I know. I'm comparing them now as we're talking, and thinking, oh, geez, if I can get him to say a couple more things that he said in that podcast,
I'll do it.
All right.
I'll rehash anything.
Well, the shame of, and it's in improv, and certainly, you know, like I teach, you know, don't worry about getting the laugh and stuff like that. The shame about telling somebody like, I want to be the funniest, or I measure my shows by how many laughs I get. Whole shame about just admitting that.
Yeah. I don't know why. I think that's just this generational, like, passed down from improviser to improviser DNA over decades of that's not the right way to do it. Improv is theater. We've got to be grounded and we've got to be truthful. And it's like, I've never had anyone come up to me and be like, oh my God, Adam, I loved your show. I can't wait to come back next week. That was the most truthful show I've ever seen. That was so grounded. Me and my husband, we held each other's hands and we were amazed at how grounded it was. It's usually, that was so fucking funny. I don't know how you, did you write that? That was amazing. Like, that's why people enjoy improv comedy. Again, unless it's a show that is... come and see the slow, grounded, it's like we're making a play live on the spot. Great. The audience knows that coming in. But from in Toronto, like where I came from, it's like people hear improv, they want comedy now. And so the idea of wanting laughs, I think that's just, it's like the idea of like doing object work. It's like, or most teachers are just like, don't go for the laugh. Or do more object work. And it's like, well, why? Tell me why I should do more object work. And some teachers are like, I don't know. My teacher told me to. So the idea that there's shame in getting laughs, I don't know. It feels like it possibly, like we're degrading the art form. But for me, it's for sure my favorite thing.
Yeah, and we were talking about that's how really we measure if a show is good or not.
Yeah.
For us.
Absolutely. Like, I want the people waiting outside for the next show to be jealous they're not in my show because the crowd is laughing so much. Within that, again, I do a duo show that is a one-act play. I want those massive laughs, but I also love those silent moments. I love the grounded work. But if there was like a pie chart, I think I'd want 80% laughs. Yeah, but again, if I'm doing a show and I'm playing with Jimmy Crane and he says, I want to be slow, grounded, don't go for the joke, I am totally into that. And that if we could get off stage and feel like we got a few laughs, but at the end of the show, people are crying and they're like, that was an amazing experience. I love that too. There's greatness in that. I think though, for me to have those moments at night where I can't sleep because I'm so amped up, it's because that show was full of laughs.
We got to wrap this up because I actually have to go to group therapy myself. and it's nothing you did. It's been scheduled, every Thursday. Cause you've done a great job, just so you know.
Thank you.
Were you looking for that or are you over that.
No, you know what? You know what I was looking for? I was like, what's the things Jimmy wants me to say that I didn't say? And I was like, I just want to rehash all of the old interview.
Well, I thought this actually was better. It was more concise than the first one we did.
Are you telling yourself that to make yourself feel better?
You know what? I'll talk about it with my therapist. And
please do.
One piece of, we always end the podcast with the same thing. One piece of advice you would give to an improviser starting out today.
I would say variety. I would say if you have the means, you know, which is a luxury, but if you're able to even just participate in jams at other shows, if you are able to get involved in as many areas of the improv community in your city, it will only help you grow. But putting all your eggs in one theater, I think can be a dangerous thing.
Adam Cauley, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
My pleasure.
This one
is
recorded. I recorded it. I'm going to shut off the recording right now.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest, Adam Cauley. Check out his podcast, The Backline, with Rob and Adam. Also want to do a shout out to Brendan Davis of the Improv Touchstone podcast for connecting me with Adam so I could do this interview. And that's another great podcast to check out. Also want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. For more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning Art of Slow Comedy classes, workshops, and intensives online, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Like us on Facebook, on Improv Nerd fan page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. And thank you for listening, because without you, I would just be talking to my cat, Coco. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Nerd is a nerd.